Continuing on, the mystery of the pole. Now we would like to mention a study by the French traditionalist Gaston Jourcel devoted to historical cycles and the logic of the cultural development of ancient civilizations, which bears direct relevance to our topic. Jourcel's book under consideration is called Rhythms in History. In this extremely interesting work, there is a small section which examines the patterns of the movements of the centers of this or that ancient civilization around the Eurasian continent. Without delving into the essence of the author's interpretation of certain patterns, we will simply provide the facts which are given and which have direct relevance to Inner Russia. Studying the geographical location of the centers of ancient civilization, Jourcel noted one astonishing peculiarity. Starting with Elam, which is around 4000 BC, and finishing in our times, we can observe a shift of certain cultures from east to west. Jourcel endeavored to draw a single line connecting the ancient center of Elamite civilization, located not far from the town of Kelat, the ancient Sumerian city of Ur, Greek Athens, and French Paris. The result exceeded all expectations. The arc connecting these centers turns out to divide them almost exactly into sectors of 30 degrees. According to the author's notes, at exactly 30 degrees along the ecliptic, the point of vernal equinox moves over a period of time equal to 2,160 years. That is, the time separating the epochs of these cultures is 4,000 years up to Elam, 2,000 up to Ur, a bit more than 2,000 years ago to Athens, and finally to the contemporary capital of Europe, Paris. The arc extending over the east at 30 degrees leads to the location of the capital of Tibet, Lhasa, and the same arc of the same curvature, merely belonging to a circle of a larger radius, connects Jerusalem and Rome. But where does the center of the circle reside? Here, once again, is a strange thing. It lies at the intersection of the meridian at 60 degrees east of the Arctic Circle, which is on the territory of Russia, north of the Ural Mountains. And let us note here that Moscow is located near to the radius which connects Athens with the center of the circle. It is with this, in fact, that Jourcel ends his account. We can go one step further and point to even more bizarre patterns. It is generally known that the line of the North Pole is the projection of the circle of the celestial sphere, along which the North Pole of the world shifts around the pole of the eclipse. And this is due to a phenomenon termed in astronomy the precession of equinoxes. But if the celestial sphere is stationary, then the globe rotates in space relative to it, or more precisely, relative to the eclipse plane, which is identical to the plane of the orbital rotation of the Earth at 23.5 degrees. This shift of 23.5 degrees is fixed on the line of the Arctic Circle. If we compare the point of the North Pole of the Earth with the current North Star, Alpha Ursae Minoris, then the center of the eclipse, and hence the true pole of the sky, will be projected on a line of the Arctic Circle. But how can we determine which exact point? Here the first globes of the Renaissance era come to our aid, on which at the same angle of 23.5 degrees, a projection of the eclipse inclined towards the Earth's equator and marking respectively the northern Tropic of Cancer and the southern Tropic of Capricorn was marked. What is important is on what meridian the projection of the sign of Capricorn is placed, which then allows one to logically determine the order of the projection of constellations on the globe, as well as to find in the Arctic Circle the point corresponding to the center of the eclipse. All old maps and globes answer this question unambiguously. On the basis of late medieval and Renaissance geographical knowledge, the sign of Capricorn, the southernmost point of the eclipse, is projected on the meridian which passes through the Ural Mountains, or the Riphians as the Greeks called them, the symbolic border between Europe and Asia. On this very meridian, 60 degrees east longitude, Gaston Jourcel conducted his study of the geography of ancient civilizations. This means that the point of the eclipse, the true celestial pole, when projected onto the globe, corresponds to the pole of the circle around which the focus of civilizations shifts over millennia. If today we are now capable of making similarly logical inferences on the basis of an elementary knowledge of astronomy and geography, then why should it be excluded that the ancients, holding such knowledge, and not being burdened by technocratic and agnostic prejudices, were perfectly well aware of the correlations between the earth and the sky, and built on these correspondences their sacred geography and the logic of their sacred history. It is most likely that the completeness of the synthetic knowledge gradually drifted into the realms of mental archetypes, fairy tales, fables, and legends, manifesting itself most openly in especially rotary periods in the history of mankind. Russians and Hyperboreans. This French traditionalist's empirical discovery of the hypothetical pole of civilizations might help explain not only a number of enigmatic facts of humanity's past, but also yield the keys to understanding one of the most strange secrets of our time, the secret of Russian patriotism, which can in no way be reduced to the banal nationalism of a particular ethnic group. Russian patriotism, in its deepest dimension, is universal and pan-human, as Dostoevsky said, himself connected with the inner continents, with the central continents located in the vicinity of the fixed points of the Wheel of Life, the circle of the wandering human soul. And perhaps it is only appropriate that the city closest to the points of this northern center was the city of Inta, which is similar to the name of the Peruvian sun god Inti and the Aryan Indra. Moreover, if we project celestial constellations onto land on the basis of the above-mentioned correlations, then our center, as well as the center of the eclipse, falls on the constellation of the dragon, the eternal enemy of Indra and the sun gods of victory. Interestingly enough, the abode of Indra in Hinduism is believed across various accounts to be in the northeast, and the name of Indra's elephant, Airavata, coincides with the Jain name of the northernmost countries on earth. But this land, as we have already said, was also called Varahi, which is the land of the wild boar. This precisely corresponds to the Greek root Bor, north, the country of Hyperborea, which is lying in the far north, the abode of the son of Apollo, who is also a dragon slayer. It is no coincidence that ancient Greek sources tell of the Hyperboreans sending symbolic gifts of wheat to Delphi via the Scythian and more northern Russian lands. It is curious that the word Varahi reminds us also of Varyagi, which are the legendary people who gave the Russians the sacred monarch. In legends of the Hyperboreans, the herbal nature of their gifts, such as ears of wheat, is always emphasized. The ancient tradition believed that agriculture was the most important ancient occupation of people prior to livestock breeding. The metaphysical view of the ancients on this reflects a fundamental peace and fixation, the sedentariness of farmers, which is put above dynamism and variability, which is nomadism and pastoralism. Moreover, the most characteristic occupation of Russians has always been agriculture. In this regard, the following fact is of interest. One of the old names for the Slavs in general was Vene or Veneti, as was one of the names of one of the Slavic tribes. And to this day, the Estonians and Finns still call Russians Vene. In all of this, it is impossible not to notice the obvious parallels with the Vanir of the Nordic sagas. The Vanir are the group of gods engaged in agriculture, in contrast to the nomads and pastoralists of the Æsir. The Vanir embody the traits of sacred peace-loving and, according to the ancient sagas, inhabited the lower reaches of the Dnieper and the Don. Here it is appropriate to recall that one of the favorite and most frequent Russian names is Ivan. Although the latter is derived from the Hebrew name John, it can be assumed that the self-designation of the Slavs survived in this Christian form. Moreover, there is a peculiar symbolic coincidence between the Gospel's tale about the head of John the Baptist and the ancient Germanic myths of the Vanir and the head of the giant Mimir, which the Vanir cut off and sent to the Æsir. This same story beheading is central in the life of John the Baptist. Just as Odin, the leader of the Æsir, enlivens the severed head of Mimir, who foretells him of the beginning of the final judgment, which is Ragnarok, so do the Christian parables tell us of the miraculous finding of the talking head of John the Baptist. Here, it should be added that the warning of the final judgment from the head of Mimir is a direct parallel to the eschatological warning of the prophet John about the coming of the Messiah. In our opinion, All of this can be explained by the existence of a united, primordial mythological complex that was rooted in the Indo-European peoples in primordial times. Historical outbreaks of this complex are always correlated with certain cyclical patterns in certain territories. The inner continents and their mythologies could slip across the planet together with their tribes, their bearers. They could be clearly fixed at certain places of the earth. They could be transferred from people to people. And finally, they could be integrated into different religious structures, thereby composing the archetypal unity of traditions. For us, the most important in all of this is identifying the specific logic of the archetypal tradition and its spiritual and symbolic content. The ethnoi which in this or that period became bearers of this tradition soak in it, turning into theophoric or idea-bearing ethnoi, thus becoming the earthly body of some kind of heavenly entity, a living idea, or an archangel. Whatever might be the fleeting historical reasons behind the sacred association of these lands and whatever peoples might have inhabited them, Inner Russia was, in its deepest dimension, identified with earthly paradise, with the territories of the Golden Age and, moreover, the symbolism of Hyperborea, Varahi, and the Vanir Ivan Tillers. Across the most different traditions, Inner Russia is constantly associated with none other than the ancient homeland of the free, immortal ancestors. To speak of a national identity of paradise is quite ridiculous. It is for this reason that every upsurge in the unconscious archetypes of mystical patriotism in the Russian people has never been comparable to any ordinary small nationalism. The Russians themselves call Russians all those who are in solidarity with them in their deep intuition of the sacrality of the lands upon which they live. This fundamentally distinguishes Russians from other peoples, and, in particular, from other Slavs, who are much more soberly and rationally conscious of national boundaries. Although something of the sort has always been characteristic of truly imperial peoples, in Russia this was and is revealed in a special form with a special force. Mystical Russia. Let us draw a few conclusions. The self-consciousness of the peoples and nations traditionally inhabiting the territory of Russia is fundamentally connected with the specific sacred geography of this territory. In the complex of sacred geography, the lands of Russia occupy a central place in accordance with the ancient logic of astronomical and astrological correlations. Consciousness of the uniqueness of Russia from the perspective of sacred geography largely determines the mystery of Russian patriotism. Russian patriotism is imbued with a cosmic fate and is not only a fact of history. He who lives and learns Russia lives and learns the secret bequeathed to distant generations of ancestors who fought under the banner of Alexander the Great, galloped across the steppes among Tatar cavalry, worshipped the Son of God in Byzantium, lit the sacred fires on the altars of Ahura Mazda, listened to the teachings of the Druids under the oaks of Europe, beheld in spiritual ecstasy the eternal dance of Shiva Nataraja, built the ziggurats of Assyria, destroyed Carthage, and sailed the seas in boats with the curved neck of the Hyperborean swan at the nose, always remembering the heart of the world, the golden heart of Russia, and mystical Russia. We are approaching an important spiritual milestone. Global forces are stretched to the limits, and in many ways the fate of our country today determines the fate of the planet. Therefore, it is important to break through to the depths of the sacrality of Russia and its prehistorical roots in order to understand its strange and sorrowful path, and to muster strength for the revival of this holy country and the rebirth of continent Russia, together with its secret, permafrost-covered center.